Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Susan Rogers, a board member with Physicians for a National Health Program, who talks about the costs and benefits of Medicare for All, and who will bear the tax burden. Mark Colville, a defendant in the 2018 Kings Bay Plowshares Anti-Nuclear Weapons Action, who explains the group's legal defense, which maintains that their civil disobedience protest was based on religious faith. And Sam Pizzigatti, associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses important new research indicating record levels of economic inequality in the U.S. and the urgent need for policy change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a rare protest against the Indian government's crackdown inside Kashmir, police arrested a number of prominent women activists, including the sister and daughter of former Chief Minister Farooq Abdullah, who has been imprisoned along with many other former Kashmiri officials. The women activists released a statement decrying India's suspension of Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which established Kashmir as a semi-autonomous territory with neighboring Pakistan. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked Kashmir's status on August 5th as he deployed an additional 38,000 troops to Kashmir, blocked phone and internet service, and detained 4,000 former officials and activists. During the August lockdown, there were widespread reports of abuses against citizens by India's security services. Thus far, India's Supreme Court has not acted on petitions challenging the suspension of Article 370 or any of the alleged abuses. Kashmir remains one of the most heavily militarized places in the world. It is the scene of a long-running insurgency and flashpoint for conflict between India and Pakistan, nations that both possess and have threatened to use their nuclear weapons. Ohio has voted for the winner in every presidential election since 1964, the longest winning streak of any state. But the results of the 2018 midterm election, combined with Donald Trump's easy win there in 2016, left many analysts wondering whether Ohio is still a political bellwether. Indeed, after decades of attention, with both parties pouring in money and resources every 4 years, some have been questioning whether Democrats should even try to win Ohio in 2020. While the state has long reflected the country's prevailing mood in voting for the president, it no longer reflects the country's changing demographics. Ohio is whiter and has more residents without a four-year college degree than the national average, groups that have supported Republicans over the last decade. Still, Democrats seem unwilling to write off Ohio just yet. An Emerson poll from early October showed Trump's approval rating underwater in the state, with 43% approval and 51% disapproval. No Republican has ever won the presidency without winning Ohio, and it's hard to see a path to victory for Trump that doesn't include it. David Pepper, the state's Democratic Party chair, says that Democrats can at least make the president work for it. But because Republican state officials are now moving to purge 235,000 people from voter lists, disproportionately impacting communities of color, this could hinder Democrats' efforts to increase turnout among African Americans and Latinos. ProPublica reports there are stark differences in the income reported from Manhattan buildings operated by Donald Trump between the information supplied to lenders versus the figures submitted to local tax authorities. The income gap is largest at 40 Wall Street, where the Trump Organization reported twice as much income to investors as they did to New York City's tax authorities. There may be legitimate reasons for such large income discrepancies at 40 Wall Street, but it raises concerns that the Trump Organization kept two sets of books, one for lenders and investors, and another for tax officials. Legal analysts say such large inconsistencies could be a sign of fraud. Former Trump advisors Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort are both in prison now, in part for falsifying tax and bank records. Thus far, two congressional committees and Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance have subpoenaed Trump's tax returns. Trump's businesses, which have often struggled to obtain credit because of his history of bankruptcies and defaults, turned for relief to a financial institution where Trump had a connection, Ladder Capital, which employs Jack Weiselberg, the son of the Trump Organization's longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weiselberg. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Democratic candidates vying for their party's presidential nomination by and large agree that achieving universal health care in the U.S. is a worthy goal, but the candidates diverge on how to reach that goal. While Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren have championed Medicare for All, mandating universal coverage, other candidates, including former Vice President Joe Biden, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, have attacked Medicare for All as too costly, too complicated, and politically unpopular. In recent Democratic candidate debates, television moderators have posed questions that repeat Republican Party and insurance and healthcare industry talking points, maintaining that middle-class Americans will both lose the private insurance policies they like and will be burdened by steep tax increases. While Sanders and Warren have done their best to effectively rebut these conservative criticisms, it's clear that they will need to be more specific about the overall cost of Medicare for All and who will bear the burden. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Susan Rogers, a board member of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Here she responds to some of the often repeated false claims about Medicare for All, while making the point that every other industrialized nation in the world, except for the U.S., has a universal health care system.
Well, there is a lot of talk about taxes, and people respond almost emotionally to just the word tax. But what we're advocating for is that there would be a small tax that people would pay, but that would be in place of what they're currently paying as part of their they pay for part of their cost of their health insurance. And I like to look at this as when you look at your paycheck, you have a gross amount at the top, and then you have multiple deductions from that amount. They go to Medicare and their federal tax, state tax, whatever. And there's also a deduction for your part of the payment for your health care, your health insurance that is on there. And what we propose is a tax that would take the place of that deduction for the health insurance, which would likely be smaller than what you're already paying. Some people are already paying a couple hundred, several hundred dollars a month for their, you know, family coverage. And so not only would you be paying less, but you'd also not have to pay any more deductibles, which can sometimes be $5,000 or $6,000 a year. You wouldn't have any co-pays. We would negotiate to get the cost of drugs decreased so that your total out-of-pocket expenses would be less. And I really believe that the bottom line on your check would be greater. You would be able to deposit more money in the bank because you're not paying this deduction for your health insurance.
Do you think the candidates advocating Medicare for All have answered the questions effectively to dispel some of the fear-mongering that's going on, particularly among conservative politicians, but also from the healthcare industry itself, which vast parts of that healthcare industry are opposed to Medicare for All?
I don't think they have. I mean, one of the biggest problems isn't just that people face isn't just what they pay for their health insurance. But the out-of-pocket expenses are just phenomenal that most people cannot afford. And one of the things that happened with the Affordable Care Act is that clearly the number of people who were uninsured decreased. But what happened was that the number of people who were what we call underinsured markedly increased. And by underinsured, we talk about where you pay, it gets tricky depending on income, but up to 5 to 10% of your income for medical bills. If that's you, then you are underinsured. And what happens is that people cannot pay $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 deductible. So essentially, they are not even able to use their insurance. So people are insured, they have an insurance card, but they can't afford to pay for it. And to me, that's just like having a car sitting in your garage. You pay the car note every month, but you don't have the keys to the car. You can't drive it. And that's what's happened to a lot of people with insurance. And, you know, they are now underinsured. So I see it a lot. People do not come in for care because they cannot afford to pay down that deductible before their health insurance kicks in.
Doctor, I wanted to mention, in addition to the tax question that comes up quite often in these debates and commentary about Medicare for All, the other question that the candidates running the Democratic primary are confronted with is, will you sign on to the plank in the Medicare for All legislation that private insurance will hereby be abolished? Tell us a little bit about the private insurance industry and what happens to it if Medicare for All gets passed.
Well, there would be no role for private insurance with a single-payer program. There's really only three reasons why other countries have private insurance, even though they have a single-payer program or government-funded health care. And that's if you have what we would call supplemental insurance, and that's where it pays for benefits that aren't already covered. So a single-payer system would really have no need for private insurance because everything would be covered. And a lot of people talk about, if I like my plan, I should be able to keep it. But I think that we're missing the really important piece of that is that people don't like their plan. They like their doctor. People like their hospital. People like where they go for services. The plan is nothing but a middleman. And so there's no reason to like the plan. Plus, you don't even know if that's the same plan you're going to have next year. You don't know if your employer is going to offer it. You don't know if you're still going to be employed there. You don't want to have to keep that job just to keep that plan when you could get the same and it would be better benefits under a Medicare for All, and you wouldn't have a $5,000 deductible.
That was Dr. Susan Rogers, a board member with the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about the costs and benefits of proposed Medicare for All legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 4, 2018, in commemoration of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., seven radical Catholic activists gained entry to the largest nuclear weapons naval base in the world in Kings Bay, Georgia. The group hammered and poured blood on the weapons in the manner that has distinguished such nonviolent direct actions since the first Plowshares action in 1980. There have been at least 75 Plowshares actions since, which works out to almost two per year over the past 40 years. The trial of the Kings Bay Plowshares defendants began in Georgia on October 21st. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Plowshares defendant Mark Colville when he was out of jail briefly before heading back to Georgia for his trial. Colville participated in a previous Plowshares action in 1997 at the Bath Iron Works submarine base in Maine and spent almost a year in prison. Here he explains the novel defense the seven are planning. Colville also calls for a reevaluation of the necessity defense, which has been almost universally disallowed by U.S. judges. It calls for acquittal based on defendants taking an action deemed illegal in order to avoid a worse outcome, in this case, illegally entering the military base, to avoid the worst outcome of the building and possible use of nuclear weapons. The Plowshares defendants face up to 20 years in prison if convicted on all four counts.
We were trying to let the court know ahead of time that we're trying to use this defense based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act is a law that is meant to really solidify and enhance the freedom of religion that is found in our Constitution. It says some specific things about people's religious practice, mainly that the government should only intervene in the religious practice of people with sincerely held beliefs. They should only intervene when it's necessary and when the government has a compelling interest to do so. And when they do intervene, that they must do so in the least restrictive way that is available to them. So we took up this law because, first of all, from the beginning, we identified what we did at the base as sacramental and prophetic action, you know, which is basically, you know, symbolic action that is trying to call into reality basic principle of faith, which is peace, you know, and disarmament, to make that real in the world today, you know. And so we took up symbols and we went to a place, you know, which we identified as a place of sin, because it's a place where killing is being prepared. And so we had to be at that place and we had to address the sin, particularly because the weapons are built for the express purpose of our protection. Okay, so that causes a crisis of faith for us as Christians, and so we felt the need to respond. So from the beginning, we've been saying that this, you know, this is a religious action, not a political action. We've been prosecuted politically, really to the full extent of the law. I mean, they've gone overboard in terms of charging us with 3 felonies and a misdemeanor. So we've attempted to use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as a way of saying, first of all, that the interest of the government in defending these weapons is not a compelling interest because the weapons themselves are a crime. They're illegal, according to our own laws.
And how are they illegal?
Well, international law that we enter into by congressionally approved ratified treaty becomes binding and superseding law in all courts in the United States. And nuclear weapons were declared illegal by the World Court in 1996. We have several judges on the World Court, and it's a body that we are subject to. So the weapons are illegal, therefore the government's interest in protecting them is not compelling interest. They should be disarmed. And then, of course, we're talking about the least restrictive means of intervening. I mean, as one of my friends said, if they really were interested in the least restrictive means, they could simply build a fence that a bunch of old people can't get through. You know, I mean, I'm almost 60 years old, and I'm the youngest one in the group of 7, you know. And yet they went and charged us with 3 felonies and a misdemeanor. So well, our contention was that that according to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that they didn't have any business charging us criminally. There were a whole bunch of other options available to them, you know, to resolve this. And they chose none of those. They chose to, you know, a political prosecution. The government, ultimately the judge, has now denied us the opportunity to make that defense before a jury. But it's still not clear whether that forbids us from mentioning or from alluding to our faith. In large part, what this trial is going to be about is not so much fact, because in large part, the facts of the case are not in dispute, okay? What they mean is what's in dispute, okay? And of course, we're contending that the criminality here is being engaged in by the government and the military, and that people have a right and responsibility to call out that crime and to call for its prosecution. That's what we say our action means. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have said that we're closer to nuclear war now than we've ever been, at least going back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, that they've actually moved the clock up. And then, of course, a large part of what we're saying is that a necessity defense needs to be given another look because of the mental health of the president, the perpetual crisis that's going on in the White House, the total instability of our government coming from the executive branch right now is really scary when you think about these weapons being under the control of the president.
That was Mark Colville, a defendant in the 2018 Kings Bay Plowshares anti-nuclear weapons action. Learn more about the action and current trial by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau, income inequality last year reached its highest level in more than 50 years. The widening gulf between the rich and the rest of the country came as a record-long economic expansion continued, but disproportionately benefiting the nation's wealthiest families. The so-called Gini Index measures wealth distribution, and Gini's recent reading for the U.S. of 0.485 is the highest reading since the Gini Index was started in 1967. Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, has echoed concerns about economic mobility in the U.S. In February, he said that income inequality would be one of the biggest challenges facing the U.S. over the next decade, and went on to say, "We want prosperity to be widely shared and need policies to make that happen." Your reporter spoke with Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow Sam Pizzigatti, who talks about the Census Bureau report and other indicators of rising economic inequality, as well as policy options to reverse the continuing upward trend in wealth disparity.
People think of the census, think about the every 10-year census, but actually Census Bureau researchers are working every year, and every year they produce an economic income report. And this latest report, released in September, concludes that inequality has grown to its highest level in more than 50 years of tracking income inequality in the United States. The report also shows that this century, the 21st century, has not been a good one for ordinary households in the United States. Our median household income, that's the income of the most typical American families, after you adjust for inflation, the typical American household is earning 2.3% less in income than these households earned in the year 2000. So average households this century are going backwards. So that's the first of these sort of blockbuster reports. The second one I had a hand in, along with my colleagues at the Institute for Policy Studies, we looked at CEO compensation in major U.S. corporations last year in 2018. We found that last year there were 50 major U.S. corporations that paid their chief executives, their CEOs, over 1,000 times the compensation that went to their median or most typical workers, over 1,000 times, which is a horrific statistic. So that's the second sort of report that we've been trying to highlight. And then the third comes from two economists at the University of California, Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez and Gabrielle Zucman. They have done some deep digging into the historical records and some fabulous research. And what they found, that last year, the 400 richest households in the United States paid taxes, combined local, state, and national taxes, at a lower rate than any other income cohort in the nation. That's the first time that's happened since the modern federal income tax went into effect in 1913. To be more specific, in 2018, last year, for the richest 400 households, in combined taxes of at the federal, state, and local level, they paid, these richest 400 households paid 23% of their total incomes in combined taxes. Meanwhile, households in the nation's poorest 50%, in other words, the poorest half of American households, they paid combined taxes at an average 24.2% rate, higher than the 400 richest households. In other words, we no longer have anything close to a progressive tax system in the United States.
Sam, both Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren have been talking about economic inequality in their campaign this year, and Bernie in 2016, about inequality and how our nation should address it. If you were to advise these two candidates or the general public about what steps could be taken to most effectively confront
and hopefully change the rising inequality we see in the United States, what policies would be most important in your mind?
We have to look at this from the traditional perspective of redistribution, and that is using the tax system to redistribute income and wealth. Those high marginal tax rates that we've been talking about served to do that in the past. And we need those, and we need to put those back into place, and we need to put them back into place more imaginatively. So things like a wealth tax come into play here. Right now, we do have a wealth tax in the United States. It's called a property tax. And if you're a middle-class homeowner, you pay a property tax. You pay a tax on the main source of your wealth, which is your home. But for very, very wealthy people, the main source of their wealth is not their home. It's their sum total of their financial assets, the millions and billions they have in stocks and bonds and commercial real estate. All those stocks and bonds and financial assets that they have face no tax. So what we need, as both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are calling for, is a wealth tax. Redistribution is not enough. We need an economy that generates more equal outcomes. And to get that, the first thing we need is a strong labor movement. In the middle of the 20th century, we had a strong labor movement, and that served to keep rewards at the top within bounds. In the 1950s, over one out of every three workers in the United States carried a union card. Today, in the private sector, less than 7% of workers carry union cards. We need to change labor laws, make it easier for workers to join unions, and that's a key part of a pre-distribution strategy.
That was Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow Sam Pizzigatti, author of the book, The Case for a Maximum Wage. Find links to Pizzigatti's recent articles on inequality and learn more about the studies tracking wealth disparity by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mika Tao. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.